I'm back. This week, we dive into a really cool double feature with Chris Brenton of Active Countermeasures. In the first segment, Matt Alderman and I, we're going to go talk about the things we love, problems, how they're solving it, the value they create. And in a second segment, Ron Gula is going to join us. And we're going to get a little bit more into how he evaluates these types of technologies, which is going to be great if you're a leader trying to evaluate technologies. This is a show you're going to love, especially if you're trying to wrap your heads around threat hunting. Business Security Weekly starts now.
This is Security Weekly, for security professionals by security professionals. Broadcasting live from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island, it's the show where we explore the business of security to improve the security of business. Your trusted source for actionable insights on leadership, communication, and innovation. Get ready for Business Security Weekly. Brought to you by today's determined attackers easily bypass even the most advanced network defenses. Trying to ramp up staff to detect their backdoors can cost thousands of dollars and take months, even years. With Active Countermeasures AI Hunter, we enable junior analysts to detect even the most advanced backdoors in a matter of hours. Sign up for a demo and purchase our product today by visiting activecountermeasures.com/BSW. Active Countermeasures, make every analyst a hunter. Are you getting pressure to improve your data security? Would you like a faster, easier, better way to patch? Then you need to check out AutoMox. AutoMox is a cloud-native platform that patches and manages every endpoint, even remote servers and devices, including Windows, Mac, Linux, and third-party software, from a single dashboard. Improve your cyber hygiene, reduce your attack surface, and save 90% of the effort you spend patching. AutoMox, your patching system of record. Do you have a website, an external presence, employees, an office? Any of these things can be compromised and attacked. How are you defending your assets? Have you penetration tested your public assets? Start 2018 by taking a proactive approach to securing your vulnerable areas. Black Hills Information Security has been helping companies find their weaknesses since 2008. Email consulting at blackhillsinfosec.com and see how they can help you sleep better at night.
Hello and welcome. Welcome back. It's Business Security Weekly, episode number 99. We're going to call this the Gretzky, and we're recording this Monday, September 17th, 2018. This is the show where we look at the business of security with an effort to improve the security of business. Really, our goal here is to be your trusted source for actionable insights, leadership, communication, and innovation. We try to bring them all together, look at them from a lot of different perspectives, and help you. And yes, I'm back. It's been an interesting summer. Still Michael Sadharkiangelo, I'm still going to be your straight-talking guide to elevated performance and accelerated results. And even though I've been gone, I've been learning a lot. I've been reflecting a lot. So much to share, and I'm excited about it. I'm excited about the format for today's show, too. And in the first segment, I'm joined by the always remarkable Matt Alderman.
Hello. Welcome back, Michael. It's been so long.
Yeah, thanks. And thanks for stepping in so much and helping out. You've been great, and it's been a lot of fun. It was a weird summer. Basically, my dad died, and then when we got done and we came back, it was time to evacuate for a hurricane, which they thought was going to bear down on Myrtle Beach. The brunt of it went to North Carolina. In fact, where we live, we're fine. We got back home last night. No damage to where we live. Kids are safe. We're safe. Everybody's safe. It's an interesting thing to be evacuated if you've ever done it or never done it, and I will try to reflect on some of that. Maybe for a future episode we can put together some sort of a segment, some things that I've learned. Some of you have reached out. I really appreciate that. But we're safe. It's been interesting. It's been a couple weeks, but we're back, and it feels so good to be back. And this show is neat. I mean, I couldn't have asked for it better. So Matt is joining me for the first segment, and he might stick around for the second. Ron Gula is joining me for the second segment. He's actually listening into the first segment, so you might hear him chime in. And we've got Chris Brenton with us, and we're going to introduce him in a second. We'll bring him on. But just let me first kind of set up what we're looking at. We're trying to take a look at a popular topic like threat hunting, popular and also popularly confusing for some people. And then what we're going to do is Matt and I are going to take a look at it from more of that business perspective. What's the problem you're trying to solve? How do you fit in the marketplace? What value do you create, right? And we're going to look at those things that we like to classically look at. And Ron's going to join us, and he's bringing forward a lot of the stuff that he looks at when he evaluates these. And he's looked at dozens, if not hundreds, of companies like this, plus his pretty impressive pedigree. And that to me, that's fun because we get to go into some of these details. But think about that if you're a security leader or you're involved in any of these types of decisions. Learning the way somebody like Ron looks at this and the questions that he asks, absolute leg up on anything you're trying to do. And it's kind of a neat way to tie this together. So we're going to see how it goes. And if it works well, there might be something we try again. Well, let me make a quick announcement. DerbyCon is holding its first ever mental health and wellness workshop. If you want to help support their efforts, go to derbycon.com/wellness. I think it's great. I think anytime we can have these conversations and do these types of things is great. I hope that if you're going to be there, that you participate and you're part of it. All right, so let's introduce Chris Brenton. He's the COO of Active Countermeasures. Now, you've heard about them on the show. Paul's involved. John Strand's involved. They brought Chris on, and they have done nothing but talk swimmingly about Chris. I think it's still nice to say swimmingly. I think technically Chris is the bee's knees, but he's got a pretty impressive background himself. And so what's great is he can talk business, and we can get into the technical stuff of it. And so we're going to talk a little bit about threat hunting. Chris, welcome to Business Security Weekly, and thanks for joining us for a pretty straight talk conversation here.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on. This is pretty cool.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. All right, so we did some prep, and Matt pointed out we should probably start by saying, okay, so threat hunting, what is it? What does it actually mean?
So this is still kind of open to interpretation. If you think about when cloud first started up, everybody was labeling their stuff as cloud. There was a lot of confusion. If you look at like Oracle started off saying, oh, the cloud doesn't exist. It's all BS. And then all of a sudden they invented it. We're kind of in that same area with threat hunt right now. You know, whereas I have my interpretation and my definition of what it means. But then when I see what a lot of other people are defining as threat hunting, I see a lot of that is also including incident handling and forensics. To me, threat hunting has one goal. Do I have compromised systems on my network? Yes or no? That's it. It's a simple binary answer to that. If you go at it from that aspect, it's fairly easy to cut through a lot of the noise to figure out what you need to do.
No, I was going to, I had a couple questions already.
Go for it.
So if we think about the security lifecycle, right? We have these preventive based technologies, detection, response, and then this concept of protect. In I've seen threat hunting kind of span into those different areas, right? And so in your pure sense of the threat hunting definition, is it really just a simple detection kind of component that says, do I have a beaconing device or a compromised device, more of a detection, and then you leave the rest of the pieces to the other players in the marketplace, or does it actually span a couple of those buckets?
Well, so here's the thing you get into. It ends up being a very slippery slope. So imagine I'm doing a threat hunt where I'm looking at my network traffic. I see an internal Windows system that looks like it's beaconing. I go in and I check my SIEM and I see that there's some log entries here I don't recognize. So I jump on the system and I start looking for, you know, what application is actually holding open that port. If you think through like the last third of what I talked about, I triggered into incident handling mode without actually initiating it internally. And that means I could end up stepping on other people's feet. That means I could end up missing things. But I also kicked into forensics mode. Which again, we have very good defined processes for that. And if we start having threat hunting overlapping that, again, we're going to start stepping on toes. We're going to start making mistakes.
You know what? You just set up my question. That was even better. My question is usually going to be around maturity, right? So if I look at Straight Talk, the last question I ask is, are we ready? And in this case, when we talk about threat hunting, my question is, so is there a maturity level required, either of the organization, of the security team, or of the individuals themselves? I mean, do we have to have a pretty robust forensics practice in place? Do we already have to have incident response in place? How do you take a look at who is threat hunting for? Is there somebody that should be considering it? Is there somebody who you should say, you'll get there, but you're not ready yet?
So I think it's that Moore's technology adoption curve thing. I think most of the folks that are in it today are innovators, innovators and early adopters. So a lot of what we have out there for tools today are, hey, here's a ton of data about your network. Some of it might have to do with the system being compromised. Here, go look at it and see if there's anything in there you actually find interesting. And now we're a threat hunting tool. And if you're, you know, if you're a John Strand, you can do that. You can sift through that data. You can, you know, write the proper SQL select statements to extract out only the bits you need to actually figure out, has the network been compromised or not? When you look at your typical security team, and again, large enterprise, this starts to change a bit, but typical security team is either, it's anywhere from like one person doing everything. So they're involved with, you know, configuring the firewall, make sure the security attestations are in place and all the controls are there for auditors and threat hunting and, you know, you name it, it comes down to that one person. Or then it eventually grows into, you maybe have somebody running that security team. You have one, maybe two senior security people that, you know, are not a John Strand, but close to it. And then you have a couple of middle people. And then, oh, hey, we can get interns really cheap. Let's bring in interns as much as we can. When you look at that type of an environment, okay, now when you look at who could do the threat hunting, it's the senior people, right? And that's it. Well, your senior people are vetting your new security solutions. They're writing your processes. They're writing your runbooks. They don't have time for you to turn around to them and say, and you need to threat hunt the network every day. There's just no bandwidth for it. So again, you know, who's ready for this? It's those folks that are in that innovator, early adapter category that understand threat hunting, that they're in security for the love of security. You know, they don't go through PCAP files because there's some job-related function to do it. They're doing it because they have a passion for it and they want to. Same thing with log entries. It's going to take us a little bit to get to where the majority of folks are actually ready to be able to do threat hunting, and that's going to come from better tooling.
So
make sense?
Yeah, so I should have log management in place. I should probably have incident response team in place, probably forensics. Then I'm probably mature enough to start thinking about being a little more proactive and do active threat hunting on my networks, right? Because without those basics, I mean, you're putting the cart way before the horse.
Well, so you, if you think about threat hunting as a black box for a second, we have an input and an output. What needs to come into it? Well, we need some way to collect the information and figure out, are we compromised, yes or no? We also need to understand those outputs. And that may be a formalized incident handling process. That may be a team that does forensics. That might just simply be a policy that says, hey, when a system gets compromised, throw it away and put a new system on the wire. I mean, it sounds silly, but that is a possible answer to that question. So a company that has no more of an answer to, have I been compromised, throw the system away and start over, yeah, they could actually adapt and start using this as well. But like I said, if you're at that point, it's kind of that, you know, like you're saying, it's that maturity path. If I don't have my incident handling together, if I don't have my forensics together, I probably don't have the talent on staff I need to be able to go in and do threat hunting.
Well, I just want to throw this out, Chris. You don't even necessarily have to answer it, but you said something I thought was interesting, which is a lot of the senior level talent that we have, They're the ones that get excited about this. They want to do this. They're capable of doing this because they've put the time in. They have the experience to do it. But gosh, we also need them helping us design architectures and evaluating security solutions and taking a look at the entire posture.
Yeah. So to me, that's two different groups. You have the kind of innovator bitweenies, and yeah, they're totally in love with just decoding packets for the sake of decoding packets, and they'll kind of latch onto this. When you talk about a senior person who's part of a security team, you know, whether it just be a generic team or a SOC or whatever, they're not. You know, one of the things we go through in our sales cycle is I'll get someone senior on the phone and they'll immediately push back, not because they don't understand threat hunting. It's not because they don't necessarily recognize that it needs to be done in their environment. They're looking at, I already work 55 hours a day. I recognize this is something we're probably going to have to do on a daily basis. So now I'm going to have, I'm going to be working 60 hours a week instead of 55 hours a week if we buy this product. Yeah, no, I don't want to go there. So again, when you start talking about the senior folks that are part of these teams, a very small number of them are going to be kind of that innovator, bit weenie. Yeah, I want to play with it for the sake of playing with it. For a lot of folks, this is a job. You know, and it's a job that also goes along with training the people that are below them, writing the processes, writing the, you know, the run books. And they're just going to look at it as, oh my God, I don't have time for this. We have one customer that was kind of cool. They're a, it's a fairly major city out in the Midwest. The security team for the city is two people. That's it. They only have two people working all the security. So they were looking at this like, we don't have the bandwidth. What do we do? We were actually able to work through it with them to kind of create a run book that they could actually hand to their help desk team. So the help desk, which is a much larger team, gets a ticket every morning, and someone on the help desk grabs that ticket, grabs the run book, goes through the process, looks at all the little pictures with the little red lines through it. Hey, if you see this, make this note, let this person know. And they kind of do the first pass on it. When you kind of think about what do we need out of threat hunting tools to make this more mainstream, really it's tools that actually do that, that kind of has that built into the tool itself, not just, hey, here's a ton of information and hopefully you can figure out what it actually means.
Because we already have a ton of tools that collect a ton of data, right? Which starts to lead me into what is that problem that threat hunting's trying to solve, right? If I have a lot of this data from my other tools, then why threat hunting? What is specific about threat hunting that we need different tools or better tools because we're trying to solve what problem? What is that?
So it's that same, you know, again, Moore's technology adoption curve. When you look at who creates this stuff, it's the innovators. It's the early adopters. So as an innovator, early adopter, I'm creating a tool that just by default is going to appeal to me. So this is going to be a tool that collects a lot of information because, wow, how cool is it that I can see everything on my environment? And then I will educate myself to be able to take it to the next step. What we need for mass market is that last piece of it, the I'm going to educate myself to take it to the next step, that actually needs to get built into the product so that what an analyst gets is not, hey, here's a couple of terabytes worth of log entries. You know, you can go in and you can write some select statements to try and thin it out, but, you know, good luck finding anything. Because I'm also really big on threat, and this is not a firm definition for me, but it is something I'm really passionate about, which is, for me, threat hunting's on the network. It's not at the host level. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is, go back, oh God, I hate to date myself, but why not? Go back 15, almost 20 years ago, and I was the guy who wrote the SANS Institute's first training course for log analysis. And, you know, I looking back at it now, I see what I was trying to do was threat hunting, but I was trying to do it with system logs. And, you know, oh my God, I mean, think about what you have with system logs for a second. You know, first of all, we've got a standard that was written in 88 by a guy at a university for his own use that a bunch of other people looked at and said, yeah, that looks great. Let's make it an RSC and, you know, everybody will use it. So, you know, syslog and everything that kind of derives off that in general is just designed to be just way too generic. I can't go in and say, grab me all the log entries with the security priority set because there isn't one. That wasn't a concern at the time this was created. So I need to go in and kind of dig through other means. I'm digging through log entries that have absolutely nothing to do with security. You know, it's kind of that, you know, let's say I'm looking at an Apache web server. Most of what comes out of Apache has nothing to do with security. I don't care. But the way our tools are set up, I kind of have to do that on the first pass and figure out what I don't want to see before I can get anything useful. Now, if you roll out Nginx on the exact same platform that Apache was on, I'm going to get totally different logs. So all that stuff I did for Apache doesn't apply to Nginx. And oh my God, change platforms from like Linux to Windows and it gets even worse. So when you start looking at logging and you start looking at trying to do threat hunting at logging, you find out you spend more time writing parsers than you do actually doing the threat hunting. What I like about doing it at the network level is it's very clear and concise. You know, in other words, attackers can try and hide their tracks, but at the end of the day, they can't hide memory. They got to stick their packets out in the wire just like everybody else. So it tends to kind of even the playing field for, you know, those that are breaking into systems and those of us that are trying to detect the attacks take place. So I tend to be more network-based versus log-based, because it gives a much smaller, better defined playground to go in and do all this stuff in. And it also means you're far less likely to slide into, oh, wait, we went into incident handling and forensics mode 4 steps ago. Hopefully we didn't taint our evidence trail if we actually need it.
So then does threat hunting try to focus those network events into something specific to kind of just really identify where those anomalies on the network are? Is that basically what threat hunting problem is trying to solve?
There's a number of ways you can go after this. One is you can try and pattern match. You know, you can go in and look and say, hey, I saw a DNS cat on the wire before. DNS, you know, so you're almost acting like an AV. Here's DNS cat. Here's what makes it a little bit different versus everything else. So I'll go in and I'll just try and match on that. You can do it heuristically. You can go in and you can do it, you know, try and take like an AI approach to it. You can do an abstraction layer that's intelligence where you go in and say, John Strand has an awesome saying, which is beaconing plus blacklist equals, oh my God, we're in trouble. You know, in other words, if I go on the network and I see a system that is clearly exhibiting beacon-like behavior and it's doing it to an IP address that's on a known blacklist, you're owned. You know, threat hunt over at that point, kick off incident mode, you know, you definitely get a compromise taking place. So how you go about doing that, I think that's some of the fun with this vertical is we're still kind of figuring out what's the best way to go about
it. No, I like that. That's kind of interesting. All right, so let's talk about your approach a little bit then, because you just said there's a couple different ways to do it, and you said something in a prep that I really liked, and we set it up a little bit today too. How do you make this accessible to somebody other than the superstars, the people that both love this and have the experience to do it? Because if we keep consolidating these things in a limited set of people, we're never really going to grow better. So let's talk about your approach. So how is ACM, how are you guys solving this problem and why?
So I think a lot of it is we looked at, we decided not to go after the elusive 1%. By that I mean, when you look at the kind of malware threatscape, there's always a 1% that never fits. In other words, you can say, oh yeah, like beaconing. You know, you can go in and you can say, okay, we're going to try and detect beacons. And someone will say, well, I'll just, you know, write malware that'll beacon once every 5 days and you'll never connect to me. You'll never catch me. Well, yeah, that's probably a true statement. And oh, by the way, you've just created malware that if you issue a command to your compromised server, you're not going to know if you got a response back in like 5 days, or excuse me, 10 days. So as a backdoor, it's kind of useless because before you can issue 3 or 4 commands, they're probably going to find you through AV or some other means anyway. So we've decided not to go after that elusive 1%. And, you know, we kind of looked at what do we need for data? What do we need for data to be able to go through and do a really good job at identifying is an internal system compromised, yes or no? And by analyzing for that beacon-like behavior, for looking for things like persistent connections that stay open all the time, when you go in and you analyze, you know, DNS, do you have 50,000 fully qualified domain names that appear to exist within a domain you've never heard of before? That's a pretty good indication that something bad's going on. So as a first pass, we kind of looked at what can we go after to catch 99% of what's out there. Then what we said is, all right, so we've got two choices now. One choice A is let's generate a ton of engineering time into trying to grab that last 1% and keep throwing data in people's faces. Or let's reallocate that time to take the data we have to work with and create that intelligent abstraction layer. And like I said, that can be intelligence you build into the product, that can be AI, you know, everybody's got a slightly different approach. But the idea goes back to what I just mentioned, which was, and actually I'll add another one in there. If an internal system is seen port scanning out to the internet and then is seen beaconing and it's talking to a blacklisted IP address, that's a compromised system. Well, if you think about the tools we have today, you kind of have to know that, right? I have to know that those three points, when you combine them together, is important enough to be absolutely definitive. Yeah, I got a compromised system. So what we're doing instead is focusing on building that intelligence into the product. So now when a junior analyst sits down, they don't need to know those three together is a problem, they'll be able to look at the dashboard that we have and see, oh, hey, it got 40 points because it was a beacon. It got another, 50 points because it was on the blacklist. And then there's another 10 points because of its scan. So the tool is telling us it's 100% certain this is a compromised system. That makes it a whole lot easier for them to get in. Now, that also kind of leads to, if you think about it from like the junior analyst perspective, what I find is they'll go through, they'll do their job, but then they get curious. It's like, well, how do you know it's a beacon? What was it about that? And you want to give them the ability to dive down into that data and to be able to show them, this is what makes a beacon. This is how we're going in and doing the analyst. So you're not only creating a tool to help them do their job more quickly. And I spend an awful lot of time talking to customers to figure out how do we make this process faster? In other words, we will have good ideas come in on occasion that is, hey, we should be looking at this type of thing. But unless we can figure out how to make the overall time to threat hunt shorter by adding that feature versus longer, I'll usually kick it to the back burner until we can figure that aspect out. But again, oh, yeah, because again, if you think about it, it isn't about the data, it's about solving the problem. And the problem is we might be compromised. Our goal as a software tool making a threat hunting product is how can we answer that question for you as quickly as possible? And I make sure that everybody stays, eyes on that prize.
So the corollary for me to this is the vulnerability management space, right? I have lots of vulnerability data. How do I know which vulnerability is more important, right? So it's that prioritization of all this data. How do I know what are the things I should be looking at, right? And so what you've done is you've created these correlations of these different events, scored them in a way to help prioritize them to make those analysts' job a little easier to say, yeah, that looks suspicious. I need to do something about that.
Exactly.
You see corollaries in other spaces as well.
Yep. I have, and that's actually an excellent, excellent example, Matt, is that I have two vulnerabilities that exist on my network. One has a severity that's twice as high as the other. They're both going to take 4 hours to fix. Which one do I fix first? Well, the double severity on one of them makes that a pretty easy choice, right? And yeah, it's exactly the same type of thing. The only real difference is that it's kind of identifying how important is this small aspect towards figuring out is the system actually compromised or not. I'll give you another example. We're starting to look at digital certificates. So when a user goes out and talks to a system on the internet and we see that it's a TLS connection, we'll take a look at the digital certificate that went by. And we're looking at a couple of things. Is it a self-signed certificate? Yes or no? Has it been issued by one of the common trusted authorities, or has it been issued by somebody who hands out free digital certificates? Is it an EV certificate? Now, I would never say that system is coming from a compromised system because it's self-signed versus being an EV cert. But if I'm looking at something that, let's say, has some beacon-like behavior to it, and I see it's got an EV cert versus a self-signed cert, yeah, that's going to shift the needle one way or another. I'm really big on, let's assign numbers. And I always kind of look at this from a 0 to 100 range. 0 is I am absolutely positive this system is safe. I don't need to worry about it. 100 is I am absolutely positive this is a compromised system. We need to kick in an incident handling mode. And everything we do tries to help people figure out where the needle is along that gauge.
So what's the value of this approach? I know some of the stuff you've talked about, it sounds like there's got to be some value in that confirmation, right? It's not an alert. It's an action. It's a guide in action. But you've also talked a little bit about the operational efficiency. So what's the value that you're seeing from this? Either the value you intended to create, or what are you finding that your clients are gaining from this?
So it's more of an opportunity to actually be able to execute on this task. There are some tools that have been out there for a while. There's a lot, when you look at the threat hunting space, when you look at the products that are there, a lot of them started off as security information and event management solutions, and now they're just kind of branding a threat hunting on it as well. So again, it's that, okay, here's a ton of data, and you better know what you're doing or you're never going to figure it out. I think moving towards simpler tools that do that work for you, it's kind of a natural progression, right? It's that when you first, when I develop software, it tends to go this way. The first release of the software I do usually has a decent size user manual. You know, AI Hunter right now has a 50-page manual. My goal is to get it down to 2 pages. And the way you do that is to stop pushing on your users, you're responsible for this, and you take that on and you deal with it yourself. And a lot of folks may look at it and say, well, wait, you can't make something this complex and not have a user manual. You can't make it that easy. And the thing I always love to push back on is the iPhone. You know, how many people have an iPhone or an Android? How much time have you actually spent reading the manual for either of those devices? And I have yet to find anyone who even knows if a manual actually exists.
I just asked my kids. They just know where all the settings are, so it's okay.
There you go. Yeah. Or, you know, you can take they try to make it intuitive enough so that you can kind of find your way there on your own if you have to. But yeah, kids work out great for that too.
So the value is kind of to the incident response guys then? Because if you can identify where systems have been compromised, that's really creating operational efficiency for the SOC as part of incident response and the forensics process, right? I mean, is that really where a lot of that value is being driven as part of the response and forensics process then?
Yeah, so where I see threat hunting in the future is right now you've got attestations like PCI that say, you know, you must have a vulnerability scan. And if you think about that, a vulnerability scan identifies the likelihood you might be compromised. It doesn't actually answer that question. We have found that out in a couple of compromises where we've had credit card processing companies that were in the middle of a PCI audit and they were passing, finding out, oh, wait, we're compromised, and the audit never caught anything. Threat hunting fixes that, because threat hunting is that I'm actually going to look and go see if I'm compromised. I'm not going to look for signs like maybe I got vulnerable software, maybe I don't. I'm actually going to go look for root cause. And that to me is huge. And that to me is something that absolutely helps with operational efficiency, because most SOCs you talk to and you say, are we compromised? They're going to say no. And then you say, okay, how do you know? Well, no one's told us we're compromised. You know, I haven't seen anything. Hmm. Well, have you gone looking? Well, no, I haven't. So it's kind of that, yeah, you're blind, and, you know, we just can't keep running blind.
Oh, that's really interesting. In fact, it feels like an evolution, right? That's a maturity evolution, as opposed to I'm looking for things that could be wrong to I'm looking for proof that I'm actually compromised. Yeah. I like that. Did I oversimplify it?
No. You hit it right on the head.
Matt, before we wrap this segment,
if it could have happened or not, I'm going to look to see, did it happen and can I pick up on it? And again, the nice thing about doing it on the network is it's all right there. If you understand IP, it's all right there. It's all easy to consume. You know, one of the challenges you run into on the host side, actually you run into a bunch of challenges on the host side, but one of which is, you know, malware is designed to hide itself. So if you're doing centralized logging and you're saying I'm threat hunting, no, you're not, because something that goes through and tries to hide its tracks is probably not going to generate any log entries at all. One of the earliest customers we have, this one's actually kind of a funny, well, it's funny for me because it's not my network. One of our earliest customers came in and said, hey, so we went through, we did a threat hunt, and we've got 3 IPs that are doing something we don't understand. But it looks like they're beaconing. It's a very solid beacon signal. They're doing it to Quanzhou, China, and we don't have a field office in Quanzhou, China, so we're not sure what's going on there. So we kind of helped out with it and found out that these 3 IP addresses were actually security cameras they had purchased. So they bought a bunch of IP-based cameras so they could put them up in the facility to see what was going on where. And these were 3 of the newest ones that they bought from a new vendor. We looked at that and said, no, this thing's calling home. It looks like it might be exfiltrating data. You probably don't want to have that on your network anymore. And it was about a month later that we found out that, yeah, that vendor was shipping it with malware. And there was a question about whether they knew the malware was there when they were shipping the product or not. So there was a situation where the world didn't know these cameras were compromised in collecting data and exfiltrating it out. And our product was able to go in and tag that, but it was an IP-based camera. If you're doing centralized logging and you're trying to do your threat hunting that way, Number one, if you can get logs out of an Internet of Things device, it probably isn't going to give you the answers to the questions you need. And number two, most of these devices won't send to a centralized logging server. So if you're, you know, when you say I'm doing threat hunting through my logs, okay, you're looking at some Windows systems and some Linux systems, but your printers, your routers, your IP-based cameras, all that stuff, you're totally blind to it. But go to the network, go to your connection point of the Internet, look for it there. Everything's right there to be picked through.
That's a great
point. The other value point, right, is by being on the network, you're not just limited to Windows, Linux, Mac devices where you can load an agent. It's also going to support these IoT or industrial IoT devices that might be beaconing without any central logging or anything else.
One of the test runs we did was John has a smart refrigerator, whacked that, and we wanted to make sure we could actually detect when his refrigerator was acting as a controlled host. Part of my background was I used to work security for a company, actually used to run the security team for this company called Dyne. You might have heard of them. They brought the internet down about 2 years ago. Part of what happened at Dyne when that happened, when you look at the signature of majority of the systems that were involved in that DDoS attack, it was thermostats. It was, you know, other random Internet of Thing devices that, again, if you're trying to just collect log entries to catch that stuff, you're never going to see it.
I love it. And we're going to get deeper into some of this when we bring Ron on here for the next segment. Matt, anything else in terms of problem, value, solution that we missed or that you think we should cover before we wrap this up?
Oh, this was a great overview, right? Threat hunting's always been one of those interesting markets. Where does it sit? You know, which vendors are in the best position to do it? How do you do it? So I think this helped a lot of people kind of understand the market a little better and some of the value by using more of a network-based approach.
Yeah, I picked some ideas out of it too, so I love that. All right, so with that, we're going to take a quick break, which is a good opportunity for you to go to securityweekly.com. Check out all the shows that we offer. Check out the on-demand content. Look at the writing we've got started. There's something for everyone, and if there's nothing for you, then read it again or send me a note. Let me know what you're missing. When we come back, Ron Gould is going to join us in. We're going to talk with Chris about how ACM works, and as I promised, it's going to be a treat to think about how to think about these things differently. Back in a minute.
Are your existing solutions able to take advantage of real threat intelligence? Common solutions like firewalls weren't designed to handle the massive and growing volume of threat indicators. This challenge often results in significant gaps in your protections, even when you think you have it covered. You need to protect yourself by filtering network traffic against unique threat indicators in a way that allows you to act. Palo Wall by Bandora Systems is the solution that filters over 10 million indicators right out of the box. Developed in partnership with the Department of Defense, Palo Wall is affordable for companies of all sizes. Get your free trial today at BanduraSystems.com. Rapid7 powers the practice of SecOps. Using shared data, analytics, and automated workflows, SecOps unites IT, DevOps, and security teams to make security an outcome of innovation. Rapid7 combines technology, expertise, and advocacy to drive vulnerability management, application security, incident detection, and log management for more than 7,000 organizations worldwide. Power up your SecOps practice with a free trial at rapid7.com/securityweekly. Skeleton keys, golden tickets, forged packs, DC sync, DC shadow. The Active Directory attack surface is expanding faster than admins can keep up with. Securing your environment begins with implementing least privilege administrative models, but does not end there. Many organizations send Active Directory syslog events to a SIM platform. However, logs are noisy, of limited scope, and are time-consuming to review and act upon. Active Directory is secure when it's clean, understood, configured properly, monitored closely, and controlled tightly. StealthBits Technologies provide solutions that monitor, secure, and detect the latest threats against Active Directory. Visit them today at stealthbits.com to learn more.
And we're back, part of our big double episode. Let me just make a quick announcement. Join us for our webcast with LogRhythm. We're going to talk about tips and tricks for defending the enterprise using open source tools. And you got 10 days to get ready for this. I know it's like Christmas morning. You're probably already got the countdown going. It's going to be September 27th. 3 p.m. Eastern time, and as always, you know it's going to be part entertaining, part educating. They call it edutainment, and that's our goal here. Check it out and get a little bit better at defending your enterprise using open source tools. All right, so let's get back to active countermeasures. So in the first segment, we had Matt Alderman, and Matt and I dug into that problem and tried to look at threat hunting differently. And I think in the end, we realized it's a maturity. It's a way of looking at stuff differently. And that's really got me firing. And I hope it's got you thinking about a lot of stuff too. Now, Ron Gula joins us. And look, most everybody watching this already knows Ron and everything he's done with Tenable and beyond. And if you want to learn more about what he's doing with Gula Tech Adventures, you can check that out on episode 82. That was probably one of the most memorable conversations we've had here. And we have a lot of great stuff here at Business Security Weekly, but I really enjoyed Ron's approach to everything. So it's a real treat that Ron's going to be here. He looks at dozens of companies routinely. He's looked at hundreds of these types of things. He's constantly thinking about where the industry is going and how to analyze and break these things down. And he said, hey, what if I come on and we talk about some of those things and I get to ask some of those questions? So Ron, from a now not rainy South Carolina, but moving its way up the coast to Maryland. Welcome, and thanks for stepping in and helping out.
I wish I could be lighting up a cigar as Paul normally does, but we're going to do it from our house today. How's everybody doing?
Yeah. I think we're doing good, and it's been a good conversation, and I'm excited because I think Chris set the stage for a lot of the things here to talk about. So let me roll back to something, Chris, that you made a comment of before. And this is something I know, Ron, that you actually asked about. So let me just kind of set that stage for people. We've talked a lot about how something like threat hunting tends to go to folks that have a lot of experience and a lot of technical ability and some level of passion and interest. And I think, Ron, the way you phrased it was, well, what happens if I take somebody who's got a basic level certification? And that's not a slight. That's just setting the stage. They're newer to security. They've done the work. They've attained some level of certification. And now they have the tool. What happens as a result? And to set that up, what happens, Chris, with your approach versus, let's say, what other people are doing with SOC automation or something else? So what does that experience look like?
So it's kind of that initial pass, if you will. You know, the senior people, as we were talking about, busy, have a lot of other things going on. It's not that they don't want to or won't get involved with threat hunting. It's more of the, you've got 1,000 other tasks. It's business prioritization. You know, do I have time to allocate towards doing a quote unquote threat hunt, not knowing, well, I'm going to find anything or not, when I know there's this problem that the CIO has been screaming about that definitely needs to get addressed. I'm going to allocate myself as my resource in that direction. If I can get somebody more junior to go through and look at it and say, okay, this IP address, you know, again, scale is 0 to 100. I'm 93% certain it's compromised, but I'm not sure. Senior person, come help me out. And now rather than doing a full threat hunt, that senior person can zero in on that one system to answer that question. Yes or no? Is this something we need to actually worry about?
I think that's a really, really great way to look at it. The question I have is, what's the minimum level of expertise to get somebody to go to the senior person?
So that comes down to the tooling, right? So if you look at something like, I'm going to take a generic, you know, let's keep it really generic. I'm just going to have all my stuff going to like a syslog server. And hey, junior person, go look through and see what you can find. Obviously, a junior person isn't going to be able to get anywhere with that. But move more towards a tool that, let's say, answers a lot of those questions for them. So for example, let's say it's a tool that looks at port scanning plus beaconing plus blacklist equals, yeah, you're compromised. And let's say the junior analyst looks at that and says, okay, it says it's compromised, but I'm noticing that it's got a, you know, well-known digital certificate assigned to the conversation. So yeah, I know it says the score is 100, but maybe I don't need to know about this. I don't know, you know, now that's when I go to a senior person, and then the senior person will say, well, because of our environment, you know, go this way or that way. Now that's something the junior analyst can work on later. So it's more about minimizing the number of steps they have to figure out for themselves in order to make them more effective. I don't think we have tools at that point yet. And I'm going to be bluntly honest, I don't think ours is either. I think we've got a good first pass, but based on, I do a ton of user studies. We're in open beta right now. Anybody who comes on as a customer is someone that has agreed to, Chris can nag you on a regular basis to watch you use the interface and answer questions about the workflow that you have going so that we can turn around and make the product better. But I think we're getting there relatively quickly.
One of the things I like about using new users or lower entry level users, so to speak, is that the product's never deployed in one day. there's usually, if you're sniffing, you might have to deploy 20 sniffers worldwide. You might have to get the network connectivity and the firewall rules. You might be having to set up an RDP to get to the system, or SSH keys, or whatever it is. They're usually IT tasks, but it's usually the type of IT tasks that kind of fall on the more junior level people in your SOC. Do you see that as a great way to get familiar and learning with products like yours?
It's definitely a good way to get kind of familiar with the environment in general. I think, you know, one of the things with the product is you need to make it as easy as possible. So if there are things like, you know, firewall rules, that's something that you need to be very clear about in the documentation. If there's something about connectivity to the boxes, that's something you almost want to try and incorporate into the product as much as you can yourself, just to try and remove as many of those barriers as you can. One of the things, so today we take bro logs and we parse those to derive a lot of the information that we use to figure out, you know, are you compromised, yes or no. The problem with that, as you were just saying, Ron, is, hey, okay, so now I got to, if I've got 20 connections to the internet, I got to deploy 20 sniffers. Yeah, that's going to take a while. One of the things we're looking at incorporating is IPFix and NetFlow, so that it's a hardware-based configuration change as opposed to setting up a spanning port and some hardware, so that initial touch point is easier. Now, with that said, there's stuff we can get out of Bro that we can't get out of IPFix. I'll give you a perfect example. One of the things we do is when we identify it looks like one of your internal systems was beaconing with somebody out on the internet, we'll give you the fully qualified domain name of that system as well. But we don't give a PTR record lookup on the IP address because that's going to be something generic. You know, that might map back to a web server that's actually hosting 50 different web servers on it. You won't know which one of the 50, you know, they were actually trying to get to. We actually look at the A record query that went out, and the IP address that came back as part of that match, or the quad A if it's IPv6, but we'll look at that match, and then that's what we actually go through and report in the interface. So that's something we can't do with IPFix. So it's kind of that catch-22. If we get a customer that wants to do IPFix, the deployment's easier, which sometimes makes allowing them to see this value in our product that much simpler. But to actually get full use of the product, you kind of have to go the spam port route. So I think it's that, you know, how do you mix those two together in a way that's going to make it easy for the environment to roll out and get the maximum amount of data?
In the previous segment, we talked about endpoint versus network. And I wanted to kind of dig into that a little bit. Because right now it's pretty trendy to go with an endpoint solution. I mean, we're seeing a lot of deployments of Cylance, Carbon Black, CrowdStrike. I mean, Tenable, we have our own agent to do vulnerability assessment. Agents are kind of the rage right now. And they do things like leave the network.
Absolutely. If I could charge per protected host, yeah, I'd make a crap load more money than we are. I can totally see going with that model instead.
I go back to ISS Real Secure. So when I was doing the Dragon IDS, Network Ice came out. And, you know, Bob Graham, he had a brilliant point. He says, look, when I put an agent on the endpoint, I'm actually sniffing on that endpoint, and I can see lateral movement. I can see pretty much 100% of the traffic versus just the gateways. And I thought that was a really good point to make to folks. What are your thoughts on that?
So it comes down to what's actually compromised, right? You know, is it a... So let's say I go with something like a Carbon Black that supports Windows and I think some Mac systems. If my hardware is what gets whacked, if it's an IP camera and it's lateral movement out of the IP camera, I might eventually pick it up with Carbon Black. But how many other things are going to get whacked along the way? It's also that, at least for me, you're kind of getting into more of a forensics mode at that point. In other words, if I can see something's made it on, I'm not saying endpoint security is bad. I think endpoint security is better from a forensics perspective as opposed to a threat hunting perspective, because the network gives you much wider visibility. You can actually see everything going on, and it only gives you as much detail as you actually need to work with. So again, for me, the endpoint versus network thing, endpoint for me kind of falls more into that forensics category. And when you look at it that way, it makes a whole lot more sense, because now if I'm doing centralized logging, I'm not going through terabytes of data to try and figure out what's going on. I have a threat hunt that told me this specific IP address might be compromised, and now I can quickly hone in on what was going on with that system, whether it be internet-based or, east to west. I can go in and I can try and look at all of that.
That's interesting. So, Ron, what's your take on separating out threat hunting from an incident response or anything around it? Because it's interesting, and I've not really thought of that. I think at the beginning of this show, I saw them as kind of coupled together. And Chris, I've heard you a couple times say, well, hold on, that's an incident thing, or that's a response thing. And what we're really looking at is the threat data, and we're going to look at it differently to get into that. Ron, when you look at it, do you like that distinction, or do you see a different approach, or how do you process that?
Well, compliance has a really big issue in both of these. So threat hunting has nothing to do with GDPR, tracking user data. I mean, obviously you might sniff a credit card or something like that. But when you have an incident, when you actually have something that you know is something that's going to be reported to possibly your shareholders or the media, that's a completely different process than trying to look for something bad. So they are distinct. There is some intersection, but they're definitely distinct processes.
Yeah, and it's part of the overall security, if you think about it. And in a way, we've kind of been missing Chapter 7 for a while. You know, we had firewalls, we had IDS, we had all this stuff going on. But when you look at incident response is supposed to trigger when we know we've been compromised. We're still trying to write that chapter, right? We're still trying to figure out threat hunting, because threat hunting will be the thing that'll kick off that incident handling. And, Ron brings up some good points, is that when you talk about, oh no, we've been compromised, all of the problems are not technical. Some of them have legal ramifications to them. So again, someone who's gone in and kind of digging through data and saying, here's this interesting thing I haven't seen before, let me throw it out on a mailing list or a blog someplace and see if anybody has answers, and use my user@visa.com or whatever email address, that could have some serious legal implications to it. That's what the incident handling process is for. It's to kick in and to say, okay, we think we have a situation. What's the runbook to identify the best way to handle that? Part of that's going to be the business aspect. Part of it will be the technical. And then again, forensics on the tail end of that, that's that process where we go through and really figure out what got on our system, what did it get access to, what data may have been compromised, and then from there we go into cleanup mode. So again, if you think of that story, think of security as a story across your environment, where chapter one is like basic firewalling. And at the end, we're kind of returning back our knowledge circle of lessons learned. We've been missing Chapter 7 for a while now, threat hunting. That's what we're actually talking about trying to pull together today.
So what does that mean for competition? I mean, when you guys look at this, and Ron, I know this is an area where you spend a lot of time now looking at this space and security overall. So based on everything Chris just laid out, Chris, I mean, what are you seeing as competition? And Ron, what's kind of popping in your head to say, well, wait, how do you compare to this versus that? What do you see?
So I want to be a little careful here, because I know I'm not always the smartest bulb out there. I've got my way of looking at this. For a lot of folks that go into this and they say, it's about the data feeds. They look at this and they say, the best way to do good threat hunting is we need this data. We need threat intelligence. We need, this data over here. Oh, what about the log data? We got to get the network data and the firewall data, and everything needs to get into one spot. And I guess I just don't work problems that way. For me, I tend to take kind of a backwards forwards approach. And when I do, forwards to the back approach. And when I do that, I kind of look at what problem are we trying to solve? Okay. Companies need to be able to identify if systems are being compromised or not. Okay, how do you get there? Well, you get there by giving these junior folks the best interface you can to simplify that process as much as possible, so that they can go through and answer, again, that one question: do I have any compromised systems? Yes or no? Is this system compromised? No. Good. What about this one? What about this one? And give them the ability to walk through that. Other companies have gone at it in other ways. And, maybe I'm totally wrong. The best way to do this may be to just go through and collect up as much data as possible and just kind of toss it out in front of the user. My frustration with that is we've actually had tools doing that for a while now, and we're still not making inroads into companies to kind of help them go in and kind of lock things down. There are certainly, you know, there are folks out there in the space that have customers that are selling product that are, you know, making money. But when you look at how many, so one of the questions we ask when people come in from a demo is, do you do threat hunting? And an awful lot of them, I'd say at least half, say no. And when you kind of dig into the, well, why the no? Well, because we haven't found a tool that's a good fit. You know, yeah, you can give us more data, but that data extracts a price from me. The price for me is my time, and I don't have that much time to invest into your tool. I need to just solve this problem and move on to the 12 other problems that I need to actually be able to deal with today.
So, Ron, how do you look at it? Oh, it makes sense. So I'm curious because I know that if I'm in the enterprise today, right, I've got to try to figure out where you fit in my approach and in my stack. So, Ron, how do you look at this and how do you start sifting it? What are some of the thoughts or questions that you have for Chris that somebody in the audience might make better decisions because of?
So I think a lot of the readers or listeners are former and active penetration testers. So they're going to be thinking about how can I break in? How can I evade detection in this kind of situation? And it's really interesting to kind of throw that out there and start playing. Well, if I did this, would you detect it? If I did that, would you detect it? There's always some sort of, you know, covert channel or some protocol that's not being monitored. There's always some sort of a thought there. But one thing I wanted to give Chris a chance to talk about is the baselining. When you monitor a network with a solution like ACM, and you have these junior level folks who are looking at this data, if they get to see what's quote unquote normal, there's tremendous value in that. Can you talk for a minute about that, Chris?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So that is one of the things that our tool does is it highlights characteristics that let's say a general network tool may not necessarily bring to the table. Things like are things performing, you know, beacon-like behavior? Do you have connections that have been, you know, held open for 4, 5, 6, 7 or more days now? That's stuff that we just don't normally get to say. The beacon one can be interesting just from the perspective of there are actually some legitimate, some it's, you know, I'll say there's white, gray, and very dark tools that use beacon-like activity. One of the common, you know, it's something everybody relies on is NTP. Network time protocol is part of my system figuring out, hey, do I still have the current time set? It's going to reach out every 15 to 30 minutes, depending upon which operating system it is, check with the time server, and then get that data back to see what the current time is. Well, it's going to do that exactly every 30 minutes or exactly every 20 minutes. That's going to look like a beacon, but that's normal and it's time, so that's okay. Then you get into things like, you know, some of the cookies and web bugs that like Akamai sets. And that's one where you can look at it and say, that one's a little bit more gray. Is it evil and going to compromise your system? Well, no, but it's still tracking me and I might feel a little sleazy. So I might want to actually get that stuff off my network too. Then there's the stuff that's actually, you know, just bad. And you want to make sure you have visibility on that. But, you know, part of my thing with I will totally agree with you, Ron, that there are folks that will kind of come up and say, oh, you know, I'm going to try and figure out a way to get around this. And in fact, that's part of the fun with being associated with Black Hills, because they do red team testing. They do penetration testing. I constantly have, you know, Joff, who does the Security Weekly shows as well as a bunch of other folks coming back and saying, hey, I think I found a way to kind of sneak around this. And I just keep coming back to, over 50% of the people I talk to, and that's the ones that are concerned enough to even reach out on threat hunting because they recognize it is a problem. I think if you looked at the folks that don't even know it's a problem, that space gets even bigger. So I'm going to throw out a round number based on my experience with no solid data points to back it up. But let's say 65% of the networks out there to 70% of the networks out there today don't do any threat hunting at all. Well, that means you could use something as old and obvious as VS Agent and totally own that home network and they'd never see it because they don't even look at it. So yeah, you can spend all your time worrying about that 1% that someone might create one thing that might sneak through. But if 65 to 70% of our networks are looking at absolutely nothing today and you get compromised by even the most basic tools that are out there, that one to me is the biggest problem to go after first. Then you can work up to the other one.
Well, let's talk about another corollary to this then. So, you know, we talk about compromises, we talk about detecting compromises, but we never really talk about what is the definition of a compromise. And a lot of times when people sit down and write it, they actually come up with something that looks a lot like a compliance policy. Who's authorized to do this? What software is authorized to run? Basically a whitelist definition of all your network connections, all your software, all your users, and that sort of thing. And inevitably, that's what we do is we go out and all of these interesting correlation rules. Hey, this host is talking to this host. They don't normally talk. This host was port scanned. There was a time, and then this other host started port scanning it, right? Or I SSH into host A, connect to host B, and now at host A. So then you're like, we all sit around and go, these correlation rules are awesome. You know, Q1's got their offense thing. Every SIM has got these things. The orchestration market does a better job than most SIM vendors do. But you run into this problem that I want to get your thoughts on is this problem of dimensionality and false positives. Just because you chain a bunch of stuff together, and like as John Strand says, there's a beacon and there's a threat list, therefore it's 100% owned. No, there could be a false positive in the beacon and the threat list, maybe the beacon said wasn't on a threat list. So what are your thoughts to all that, especially with this concept that we're starting to do this for new people in the SOC?
Yeah, and I think that definitely gets into, you know, why we need to trigger incident handling and go into forensics from there. I think the threat hunter has to do the best job they can. And if they have a tool telling them it looks like a beacon and the tool's telling them it's on a blacklist, you get to kind of run with what's there. It may turn out that, yeah, both of those are false. But again, if we can kind of get the junior person to kind of do that initial vetting, the senior person may come in and say, oh no, that's NTP and I don't know why that system's on a blacklist. Just to throw out an example, well, okay, fine. Maybe we just whitelist that now to make that go away. Or, you know, maybe there's an inherent problem we just don't understand. But yeah, I think it's the incident handling process that needs to kind of trigger in to kind of deal with it that way. The other thing that kind of strikes me is that the guys at Netflix have a good saying, which is our servers used to be pets. We used to give them names. But now they're cattle. When they get sick, we just shoot them and spin up another one. And we're kind of getting to the same spot with desktops today, meaning that, you know, what is your forensic response? You know, as I said, one possibility is throw the damn box away and buy another one. You see in more sites where everything is, you know, Office is a SaaS service or it's Google is a SaaS service. There really isn't much of value on that thing besides a browser. So, you know, what's the proper way to respond? That comes down to business priority, but one of them may be just throw the damn things away and get something new. Be done with it, and now you can move on. And when you look at it from a cost savings perspective, it actually looks pretty competitive.
So one final tough question then. Let's assume that that is the future where your endpoints have been thrown away and you used to have browsers on them, and you're basically doing SSL and you're going out into the cloud. You're going to O365, you're going to Dropbox, you're going to NetSuite, Gmail, G Suite, Office, you know, whatever. What's the future of network security monitoring in that kind of environment?
It kind of depends on the, you're absolutely right. And in fact, you could kind of argue with remote workforce that makes that tougher as well. If I've got a 100% remote workforce and I have split tunneling enabled, which means everybody just goes directly out to the internet, I've got no way to kind of centralize my solution to go in and try and find a compromised system. Absolutely, that's a problem. Where I see a lot of it going is moving towards being able to consume and deal with things like Amazon VPC logs in order to be able to go after stuff that gets situated that way. Although even that becomes questionable because now you start getting into services where you know, it's platform as a service. I wrote a Python script that's now being executed by the cloud provider. I might not have a whole lot of logging ability capability there as well. So yeah, definitely a lot of challenges coming up. Absolutely.
Yeah. No, I mean, I mostly in like note taking and figuring it out mode. And I was curious if there's anything else that came to your mind, but it sounds like we've wrapped it up, and I know we're going to wrap this segment. So, Ron, thanks so much for joining us. Chris, thanks so much for your candor. We definitely didn't make it easy on you by bringing in both Matt and Ron to have this type of a conversation, and I appreciate your willingness
awesome. Thank you.
To engage. Yeah, no, this is, we need more of this in the industry, and so, Ron, I hope you'll come back and join us more and bring these types of questions, these insights, because I know there's a lot of security leaders out there that are feeling overwhelmed by this type of stuff. By listening to this, thinking about the questions, and listening to the way you approached it, I am 100% confident that they'll be better at what they try to do. So that wraps us up for this episode. We're getting back into the swing of things as we hit to the fall. Always want to hear about the things that you want from us. If there's challenges that you're facing, technologies you want us to take a look at, I've been paying attention to some of the research that's coming out. Some of these ideas that were floating that sound great. We're going to try and find some guests to talk about that. If there's things that you want or things that we can do to help you do better, shoot us a note, and you can always find me on Twitter at Catalyst. You can find Paul at Security Weekly. You can hit me up on LinkedIn. Let us know what you thought of today's show in that double segment approach and what else we can do. And I'll leave you with this for the week. Exceptional leaders elevate people around them. Here's to a great week of investing in yourself in a way that elevates those around you. See you next week.